D.I. Jim Clemo, I said, I'm so sorry about Ben. John Finch. His handshake was a quick, firm clench with bony fingers. There was a small table in the room, two chairs on either side of it. D.C. Woodley and I sat on one side, Finch on the other. I went through the same process as with Ben's mother, starting him at the beginning with date of birth, childhood, etc. What people don't realise is that one of the first things we have to do is prove that they are who they say they are, and that the crime they've reported really has happened. We'd look pretty stupid if we investigated and it turned out that the people involved didn't actually exist, that they'd spun us a lie from the outset. And God knows the press and public can't wait to make a meal out of any instances of police stupidity. Finch answered my questions in a muted, economical way. I'm afraid we have to spend some time on what might feel like irrelevant detail, I said to him. I felt the need to apologise, to try to make the situation slightly easier for this man who was so obviously sensitive and so obviously trying to hide it. But please be assured that it's essential for us to build up a picture not just of Ben, but his family too. I know the importance of a personal history, he said. We rely on it heavily in medicine. John Finch's backstory was quite straightforward. He was born in 1976 in Birmingham, an only child. Dad was a local boy, a GP, and mum a violinist. Her parents had escaped Nazi-occupied Vienna while her mother was pregnant with her, and then settled in Birmingham. Finch was close to his parents, as well as his grandparents, throughout his childhood. He was a scholarship boy at the grammar school. He did well and won a place at Bristol University Medical School. He'd arrived in Bristol to start his degree 20 years ago, in 1992, and never left after that. He worked his way up and done well. Proof of that was his current position as consultant at the Children's Hospital. He'd become a general surgeon. I knew just enough about the world of medicine to know that that must be a coveted position in a competitive world. Finch's composure first faltered when I wanted to talk in more detail about Ben's mother and the reason their marriage ended. My marriage ended because Rachel and I were no longer suited to each other. A perceptible stiffening of his body, words a tad sticky as his mouth became drier. It's my understanding that this came as a surprise to Rachel, possibly, and that there was another party involved. I have remarried, yes. Could you give me an idea of why you and Rachel were no longer suited to each other? A single bead of sweat had appeared by his hairline. These things don't always last, Inspector. There can be a host of small reasons that accumulate to make a marriage unsustainable. Including a younger girlfriend? Please don't reduce me to a cliché. I didn't reply. Instead, I waited to see if more information would seep from him, just as the perspiration had. It's surprising how often that works. People have an almost compulsive need to justify themselves. I made a show of looking through notes, and just when I thought he wouldn't spill, he did. My marriage wasn't an emotionally fulfilling one. We didn't... He was choosing his words carefully. We didn't communicate. It happens, I said. I was lonely. His eyes flicked away from mine, and I saw a frisson of emotion in them when our gazes reconnected, though it was hard to say exactly what. John Finch was definitely a proud man, and unaccustomed to sharing the personal details of his life. Is Rachel a good mother to Ben? I asked him. I wanted to catch him when his guard was down. His reply came immediately. He didn't need to think about it. She's an excellent mother. She loves Ben very much. I took the interview back to practicalities. I asked him what he and his wife were doing on Sunday afternoon between 1 and 5:30. He said that they were at home together. He was working and she was reading, but then she started to prepare the evening meal. He got a call from WPC Banks at 5:30 to inform him that Ben was missing and he'd driven directly to the woods. Did you make any calls or send any emails during that time? I asked. He shook his head. I was catching up on paperwork. I've asked Mrs. Jenner whether she'd be willing for us to look through her phone records, and she's agreed. Would you be willing for us to do the same? Yes, he said. Whatever it takes. And one more thing. Yes. Have you had any incidents at work where patients or their families have been unhappy with you? Could somebody be bearing a grudge against you? He didn't reply to my question immediately. It took him a moment or two to consider it. There are always unhappy outcomes inevitably. And some families don't take it well. I have been the subject of legal action once or twice, but that's normal in my line of work. The hospital will be able to supply you with details.
You can't remember them?
I remember the names of the children, but not their parents. I try not to get too involved. You learn not to dwell on the failures, Inspector. The death of a child is a terrible thing to bear, even if the responsibility isn't ultimately yours, because you did everything you could. Even through his fatigue, the look he gave me was sharp, and I felt as though there might be a warning in his words somewhere. I drove out to the woods after the interview. I wanted to see the scene for myself. I took a pool car. The drive gave me a chance to get out of the city for a bit and think about the interviews, get my thoughts straight. My impressions were that the parents were both private people, though John Finch was possibly more complicated than Rachel, and certainly more proud. They were both intelligent and articulate, a classic middle-class profile. It didn't mean that they were whiter than white, though. We had to remember that. In forensic terms, the scenes at the woods were carnage. The combination of shocking weather, multiple people, animals and vehicles had churned up the paths, and especially the parking area. I took a walk to the rope swing, where Ben was alleged to have gone missing, and regretted forgetting to bring Wellington boots. It was a damp site, with trees crowded round it. It gave me a creepy, sinister feeling, like you get in fairy tales. And in some way, that was more unsettling than some of the rankest urban crime scenes I've visited. I talked to the scenes of crime officers. They were nice guys, cheerfully pessimistic about their chances of finding anything that might be useful to the investigation. "If I'm honest, it's not looking good," one of them said, stepping over the crime scene tape. It was bright yellow and hung limply across the pathway that led to the rope swing. He pulled a plastic glove from his hand so that he could shake mine. "The conditions are atrocious, but if there's anything to be found, we'll find it." I gave him my card. "Will you," he interrupted me, "call you if you find anything, of course." We had our first full team briefing with Fraser at 1600 hours back at Kenneth Steele House. We gathered around the table, everybody ready to work, tense and serious, trying not to think about where this case could go. A missing kid is the kind of case you do your job for. Nobody wants a kid to be harmed. You can see it on every face there. "First things first," said DCI Fraser. "Code name for this case is Operation Huckleberry. We're hunting for two people. Ben Finch, 8 years old, and whoever has abducted him. They may or may not be together. The abductor may be a member of his family, or he or she may be an acquaintance, or indeed a complete stranger. They may be holed up with Ben, or they may be living normally on the surface and returning to Ben occasionally. They may already have harmed or murdered Ben. We need to keep open minds." She cast her eye around the table. She had everybody's attention. "Expertise is on our side," she continued. "I'm confident that this team of people represents excellence, and I expect it of you. Time is not on our side. It's been 24 hours since Ben Finch went missing. Priority is to confirm Mum's story and speak to all the people she said she saw in the woods that day." She paused, making sure we were taking it all in. "I personally feel that the members of the fantasy reenactment group who are in the woods during the afternoon are of particular interest, because I suspect that amongst them there'll be one or two mummies boys who are wielding swords at the weekend to make up for being sad, pimply little bastards who can't get a life during the week. Which brings me on to another matter. I think we're going to need all the help we can get on this one. The number of actions we've identified already is daunting, and it's certain to get worse before it gets better. I've asked for more bodies, and I've twisted the super's arm so that he's agreed to fund the services of a forensic psychologist for the short term at least, to help us define our primary suspects. His name is Dr. Christopher Fellows. He has teaching commitments, and he's based at Cambridge University, so he's not going to be with us in person unless we have a very good reason to bring him over here, but he'll be available to advise remotely." I knew him. We'd worked with him when I was with Devon and Cornwall. He was good at his job when he was sober. "I was going to get Mum and Dad in front of the cameras tonight, but I think we'll wait until first thing tomorrow morning. I've televised a short appeal for information, which we'll do for now, and we'll put that out with Ben's photograph. I've had preliminary reports from most of you, but if there's anything new you want to add, speak now." One of the DCs put up her hand. "We're not in school, you can keep your hand down." "Sorry, it's just that I got a possible. We tracked down all but one of the men on the sex offenders list." "Who's missing?" Name of David Callow. He's 31 years old, did time for abusing his stepsisters and posting photographs of himself doing it. His parole officer hasn't heard from him for a fortnight. Make him a priority. I want to know about who he last saw and when. Talk to his family, his neighbours, his friends, if he has any. Find out what he's been doing. Anything else? Nobody spoke. Right, there's a lot to get on with, so let's get on with it. Any leads, any worries, anything gets on top of you, speak to me. I want to know everything as it happens, no exceptions. Webpage. Breaking news, police. www.aspol.uk/whatsnew. 22nd of October, 2012, 1303. Avon and Somerset Constabulary has activated Child Rescue Alert to assist in tracing 8-year-old Benedict Finch in Bristol. A dedicated telephone number has been established for anyone who has seen Benedict or has information about his whereabouts. This number is 0300 300 3331. Calls to this number will be answered by dedicated members of staff who will take details of any information provided to assist with the inquiry. By launching Child Rescue Alert, which is supported by all UK police forces, it is hoped that the public and media can assist Avon and Somerset Constabulary in safely tracing Benedict. Police are seeking information specifically from anyone who has seen Benedict or anyone matching his description in the last 24 hours. Benedict is described as being of Caucasian appearance, of slim build, and just over 4 feet tall. He has brown hair and blue eyes and freckles across the bridge of his nose. It is not known what he is wearing. A recent photograph of Benedict has been widely circulated. It can be seen on the Avon and Somerset Constabulary website. He was last seen on the main path round Lee Woods, just outside Bristol, at around 16:30 on Sunday the 21st of October, when he and his mother were walking their dog. His mother raised the alarm at 1700 hours after extensive searching in the woods did not locate him. Intensive searches led by trained search officers, and including police dogs and mounted police, are taking place in and around Lee Woods and the surrounding area, and members of the public have been assisting. Benedict is described as bright and clever, a fluent communicator, and English is his first language. He is known to his family as Ben. Spread the word. Facebook, Twitter.
Rachel. My sister Nikki was waiting for me in the foyer at Kenneth Steele House. She was panda-eyed with strain. I fell into her arms. Her clothing smelled of damp cottage and wood smoke and washing powder. She looks a lot like me. You could tell we're sisters if you saw us together. She's got the same green eyes and more or less the same face, and a similar figure, though she's heavier. She's not quite as tall as me either, and her hair is cut short and always carefully highlighted. So instead of being curly, it settles in brushed golden waves around her face, which makes her look more sensible than me. Nikki told me she'd driven straight from Aunt Esther's cottage. She held me tightly. The hug felt awkward. We probably hadn't been in each other's arms since I was a child. I wasn't used to the padded curves of her body, the cotton wool softness of the skin on her cheek. It made me acutely aware of my own frame, its angularity, as if I were constructed from a more brittle material than her.
"Let's get you home," she said.
And she brushed a strand of my hair back behind my ear. Arriving home was my first taste of how it feels to live life in a goldfish bowl. Journalists had gathered outside my little two-up, two-down cottage. Ben and I lived on a pretty narrow street of small Victorian terraces in Bishopston, an area that has yellow neighbourhood watch stickers in many house windows and loves recycling and having street parties in the summer. Our neighbours were a mix of elderly people, young families, and some students. Ours was a quiet street. The biggest drama we'd collectively experienced since I'd lived there was waking up to find drunk students had put traffic cones on top of the car roofs during the night. The journalists were impossible to avoid. There was a group of them, big enough to spill off the pavement. They called my name, thrust microphones towards us, photographed us as we entered the house, pushed and shoved and tripped up as they ran around each other trying to get in front of us. Their voices were cajoling and urgent, and to me, they had the menace of a mob. When we got inside, black dots danced at the edges of my vision, the after-effects of the bright white of their flashbulbs, and I could still hear them calling from behind the door. My heart rate didn't slow until I moved into the kitchen at the back of the house, and there it was silent, and I was able to sit and breathe and focus on the placid ticking of my kitchen clock. Chang stayed with us for a short while. The scenes of crime officers had visited the house while I was being interviewed. She wanted to check that they'd left everything in order upstairs, in Ben's room. She pulled the curtains in the sitting room tightly shut so that the journalists couldn't see in. She advised us not to answer the door without checking who was there, and not to speak directly to the press.
"It's good that they're here, though," she said. "It's all good publicity because it means that as many people as possible will be aware of Ben and will be looking out for him."
She made sure we had her card and her number on it, and then she left us alone. Part of me didn't really want her to leave. She was more approachable than Clemo by miles. I felt nervous of him, of the authority he exuded, of his matter-of-factness and of the power he suddenly held in our lives. But Chang was different. More of a kindly guide who might be able to help me navigate this horrendous new reality. And I felt grateful for her. Everything on the kitchen table was as Ben and I had left it. A snapshot of our last few minutes in the house together. There was a hat that Ben had refused to wear. A packet of Bourbon biscuits that he'd raided just before we left. A much-loved Tintin book and a Lego car that I'd helped him build. His school report, received in the post the day before, lay on the table too. It had been a pleasure to read, full of effusive praise from his teacher about how hard Ben tried, how pleased she was that he was finding the courage to speak up more in class, and how he was gaining confidence in his schoolwork. And it wasn't just the kitchen. There was nowhere in this house that wasn't imprinted with traces of my son. Of course there wasn't. It was his home. Even outside, down the short, uneven garden path, I knew that there would be signs of him, too. In my garden office, my computer would be sleeping, its light blinking unhurriedly. If I went out there and brought it to life, I knew the internet history would show a game that Ben had been playing online on Sunday morning. It was called Furry Football, and the aim was to play games and earn points to buy different animals, which would form a football team. Ben loved it. I had a daily battle to limit his time on it. I looked at everything, took it all in, but felt only blankness. All of it was meaningless without Ben. Without him, my home had no soul. Nikki got busy, typically. She'd always been like this. She was never still. If there was nothing to do, she would organize an outing or make an elaborate meal. Activity was her way of relaxing. When I was younger, I could happily spend an afternoon in Esther's cottage doing nothing more than sitting on the window seat in my little bedroom. I would trace outlines in the condensation on the glass, gaze at the frosty trees outside and the shapes they carved against the open sky behind them, and watch the birds on my aunt's feeders fighting for seed. The sharp yellow flash of a goldfinch's wing was a sight I longed for in the monochrome of a snowy rural winter. Eventually, driven by the cold, I might make my way downstairs to seek the heat of the fire. Nikki would be there with Aunt Esther. Their cheeks would be flushed from the warmth of the oven and the exertions of whatever activity they'd been engaged in. I would admire the freshly baked cake they'd made or smell the stew that was simmering. Aunt Esther would take my hand and say,
"Rachel, you're so cold. Have a cup of tea, darling."
And she would rub them, and I would feel rough gardening calluses on her palm. Nikki would say,
"Where are your fingerless gloves, Rachel? The ones I gave you for Christmas."
Then I would slip away from them, their cozy domesticity, and slink into a chair by the fire, pull a blanket over myself and lose myself in a book, or the dancing of the flames. In those early days after Ben disappeared, when I was practically catatonic with shock, it was natural for Nikki to become the functioning part of me, just as she always had done. She returned the increasingly frantic messages that my best friend Laura had been leaving on my phone throughout the day and asked her to come over. She spoke to Peter Armstrong, who told her that the dog's leg had been broken, but he was comfortable at the vet's after having it set. She put her laptop on the kitchen table and spent hours online. On that first day, she found a missing kids website based in the US. On their advice, she made a list of questions for the police. She threw facts out into the room as she learned them. They were ghastly. Notes from a world that I didn't want to be a part of. They made me feel queasy, but she was unstoppable. She told me that the website advised that bloodhounds are essential for a proper search, that they can follow the scent of a child even if their abductor has picked them up and carried them away. She asked me what dogs the police had used in the woods. I said they'd been German shepherds. She continued to read quietly, scratching notes out on a pad, keeping it shielded from me, her mouth set in a grim line. After a time, she said,
"Did you see John after your interview?"
"No. They took him somewhere else."
"You should ring him. It would be good to know what they asked him."
"He blames me."
"This is not your fault."
"I knew it was."
"What did they ask you? Can you talk about it?"
"They asked me everything. They wanted so much detail. Family history, everything to do with Ben since he was born. Anything you could think of, basically."
I didn't mention that they wanted to know what Ben had had for lunch on Sunday.
"Did they ask about our family?"
"They wanted to know everything."
"What did you tell them?"
Her eyes lifted from the screen, and they were red-rimmed.
"I told them what happened. What else would I tell them?"
"Yes, of course."
She turned back to the screen.
"It says here that the family should try to agree on a tactic for how to approach relationships with the police, that it's really effective to do that."
"I can't phone John now." I couldn't face it. I'd committed the worst sin a mother can. I hadn't looked after my child. "I'm going upstairs."
In Ben's bedroom, I could see very little sign that the scenes of crime officers had been there. One of Ben's favourite toys lay nestled on his bed, in the tumble of bedding that Ben liked to sleep in. It was Baggy Bear, a doe-eyed teddy with chewed ears, floppy arms, soft fur, and a blue knitted scarf that Ben liked me to tie in a certain way. I held Baggy Bear to my chest. I thought, I can't leave this house now, in case he comes back here. Everywhere, the silence, the absence of Ben seemed to swell. It felt hostile, like the furtive spread of a cancer. I lay down on Ben's bed and curled up. There was something making me uncomfortable, and I shifted position, felt for it. It was his old cot blanket. He called it Nunny, and he'd had it since he was a baby. It was very soft, and he would wrap it around his fingers and stroke his face with it to get himself off to sleep. He'd never admit it to anybody but me, but he couldn't sleep without it. I tried to push away the thought that he'd already had to spend a night without it, but that might have been the least of his worries. I balled it up, hugged it to myself, along with Baggy Bear. I could smell Ben on the nunny, on the bedding and on his teddy bear. It was the perfect smell that he'd always had. It was the smell of baby hair that has no weight to it, and of the skin on his temples, which was still velvety smooth. It was the smell of trust, freely given, and a perfect, innocent curiosity. It was the smell of our dog walks and the games we'd played together, and the things I'd told him, and the meals we'd shared. It was the smell of our history together. I inhaled that smell as if it could revive me somehow, give me some answers or some hope. And, like that, I just waited. I didn't know what else to do. When Laura arrived, Nicky let her in, and I heard their voices downstairs, hushed and serious. In real life, the life we were living before Ben was taken, they didn't get on very well. I was the only thing that these two women had in common, and their paths had only crossed once or twice before now. Without me, they would never have spent time together. Probably not without a large measure of irritation, anyway. As a foil to Nikki's conservatism and her serious, thoughtful approach to life, Laura was skittish, playful, inconsistent, rebellious, and sometimes downright wild. She was a bird-like person, tiny-framed, with short urchin hair, wide brown eyes, and a big laugh. When I'd first met her, when we were both nursing students, right from the start she'd made me laugh, taught me how to play. She was the first person I'd met who did that for me. It thrilled me. She wasn't like that 100% of the time, of course. She had her moments of darkness, too, but she kept them private. I only glimpsed them when alcohol had loosened her tongue.
"I was a mistake," she said once.
I'd known her for a good few years by then. We were no longer students, although we were still in our habit of going for a big night out at least once a week. Her words were heavy with booze.
"My parents didn't want to have me. It's ironic, isn't it? The two people who were amongst the brightest minds in the country, or so they like to say, it's ironic that they should have made such a basic error, don't you think?"
Her tone of voice was attempting to be jokey, but the corners of her mouth kept dragging down, and her eyes were dull and tired.
"Didn't they want to have children?"
"No, it wasn't the plan. It was never the plan. They were very open about that. If I'm honest, I'm surprised they ever had sex. They were old when they had me, too."
She laughed.
"They must have stumbled across a manual that told them what to do and had 10 minutes to spare before news night."
I didn't have parents, of course, so who was I to pass judgment on how she mocked hers? But there was something unsettling about her tone, and though I'd laughed obligingly at the time, it had made me feel sad.
"Do you want kids?"
I'd asked her, for I had a secret that night. It was the reason I was sober.
"Oh, I don't know about that."
I thought I saw a look of sadness flash across her face.
"But never say never."
She closed her eyes, giving in to the lateness of the hour and the soporific effect of the wine. I sat beside her, not ready for sleep yet, and slipped my hand underneath my top. I rested it on my belly and thought of the baby growing there. It was Ben. My mistake. Already loved. The tread of Laura's feet on the stairs of my house made them creak cautiously, and she paused at the top and said,
"Rachel. In here."
At the doorway to Ben's room, she said,
"Do you want the light on?" "No."
She lay down beside me, put her arms around me in a hug that was far more familiar than Nikki's.
"I didn't keep him safe," I said. "It's my fault."
"Shh," she said.
"Don't. It doesn't matter. All that matters is getting him back."
Even in the gloaming, I could see that her eyes were liquid. A tear escaped and ran down her cheek, pooling by her nose, a trail of black eyeliner in its wake. We lay there until the darkness outside was becoming a solid mass, leavened only by the glow of the streetlights and the geometric oddments of light that fell from people's houses. We'd been told by Chang to watch the news at 6 p.m. At 5:45, I realized that I should have been at Ben's parents' evening to discuss his report. Laura said,
"Don't worry about that. Don't even think about it. You can go later in the week, once he's back."
The first item on the news was a report on flooding in Bangladesh. Thousands of people had died. Ben was the second item. DCI Fraser, who I'd met briefly, stood on the steps at Kenneth Steele House and appealed to the public to help them with their inquiries.
"We're extremely concerned about this young boy," she said, "and we would urge anybody who has any information about him or his whereabouts to get in touch with us."
She was immaculate in police uniform, wildly curly grey hair and a pair of wire-rimmed glasses that sat at the bottom of her nose under sharp eyes gave her the look of a blue-stocking academic.
"We are also requesting that the public do not organize searches of their own," she said, "though we thank the members of the community who are offering their help."
A helpline number and the photograph of Ben that I'd given the police flashed up, filling the screen. It's the strangest thing in the world to find that the story you are watching on TV is your own. To realize that you have entrusted a stranger with finding your child, and to then have to accept that you are as disconnected as anybody else watching. That you are essentially impotent. When Ben's face had gone from the screen, Laura turned the TV off. I wanted to howl with sorrow, or to rage, but I did neither, because my hand shook and my stomach was turning, threatening to disgorge the tea I'd been sipping, the tiny morsels of toast I'd forced myself to swallow at the behest of my sister. The call about the press conference came later that evening. The police wanted me to appear in front of the cameras the next morning to read out a statement appealing for help in finding Ben. They would send a car for me.
"I can't leave the house," I said. "What if he comes home?"
Laura said,
"I'll stay here. You've got to go. I'll stay here."
"Should I stay?" said Nikki. "I could stay."
Both of them looked at me, wanting me to decide.
"Nikki should come with me," I said.
Laura was my best friend, but Nikki was Ben's aunt. Our only family.
"She's right," Laura said. "You should be there."
She looked at me.
"And it can only be good if you appear on TV. People will care more about Ben. They really will. I'll come over in the morning before you leave, and I won't leave the house, not even for a minute. Not until you're back, I promise."
Laura told my sister that she should choose an outfit for me to wear, that I should be as presentable as possible. She said it was important, even if it felt trivial to think about it at a time like this. She looked closely at the gash on my forehead, and I winced when she touched the edge of it.
"I don't think you can put makeup on it, if that's what you're thinking," Nikki said. "It's too raw."
Laura peered at it. I could see her eyes following its trajectory across my forehead.
"Let's see how it looks in the morning," she said.
"Could we cover it with a dressing?"
Nikki asked.
"No, a dressing will look ugly on TV, and it'll obscure her face. Worst case, we leave it as it is. It's not that noticeable."
We all knew that wasn't true. In the kitchen, after Laura had gone, with a promise to return first thing in the morning, Nikki said,
"Do you trust her? I'm not sure she should be here on her own."
"What do you mean?"
"She's one of them."
She gestured towards the front door, the pack of journalists lingering outside, whose voices we'd heard rising and swelling throughout the evening, breaking into laughter now and then.
"She's not that kind of journalist," I said. "She writes for gossip magazines."
about makeup. It's fluff. Bullshit. It's not news.
They're all the same breed.
She's my friend. My best friend.
Fine. If you trust her, then that's fine, isn't it?
I do trust her. I can't believe you'd say such a thing.
Sorry.
The kettle was noisily reaching boiling point. Nikki leaned against the counter and lapsed into a thousand-yard stare. But I knew her, and I knew that behind it, her mind was turning. For the first time, it occurred to me to ask about her family.
How are the girls?
Her attention snapped back to me. A funny look. Guilt, perhaps, swiftly disguised, because she had four daughters safe at home, while I was missing my only child.
Will you tell them?
I asked.
I think it'll be impossible to avoid, with it on the TV and in all the papers.
Do they need you to be with them? Don't you need to go home?
No.
She said it firmly.
My place is with you right now. They'll be fine.
She closed the matter by turning her back on me to make tea with concise, measured movements. After we went to bed, I couldn't sleep. All night I kept vigil in Ben's room. I left the curtains open and lay in his bed, letting my eyes run over the contours of his belongings. Books, toys, and other stuff, collected and arranged by Ben on his shelves, had the stillness of museum exhibits. I sat up, wrapped his duvet around me, and stared into the shadows in the corners of his room, and then moved my gaze outside. I watched a fox leap the fence into my neighbor's garden, and then slink around, nose to the ground, before finding something it could eat and devouring it, gulping it down in a way that was fast and primitive and ugly. When it was done, it ran its tongue over its chops, savoring, before disappearing into the night. I felt the various textures of my fear. Shivery, visceral, tight, pounding, in turn or all at once. I only fell asleep once in the small hours, and woke to a sensation of being choked, gasping for air, pushing bedding away from me as if it were hostile or venomous, and then finding my sister standing in the room with fear on her face, saying,
"Rachel, are you okay? Rachel!"
After that, we sat together until it was morning, as if it was just the two of us left in the world.
Jim. Addendum to D.I. James Clemo's report for Dr. Francesca Minelli. Transcript recorded by Dr. Francesca Minelli, D.I. James Clemo and Dr. Francesca Minelli in attendance. Comments to indicate observations on D.I. Clemo's state of mind or behaviour, where his remarks alone do not convey this, are also included. What I'd like to start with today is a discussion of your relationship with D.C. Chang. There's not much to say. You were seeing each other when the Benedict Finch case started.
Yes.
How long had your relationship been going on?
About 4 months.
And things were going well?
They were, yes. I thought they were.
But you kept the relationship secret from work.
I didn't want gossip.
Were you embarrassed about the relationship?
No, God no. Anyone would have been proud to go out with Emma.
Why is that?
She's very clever and very gorgeous. Funny, too, when you got to know her.
She sounds lovely.
She was even better than that, though. I'm not describing her very well. She was different from other girls I've been out with.
How was she different?
She was just... Well, she wasn't dull like them. It's like she lived a different kind of life, and she wasn't afraid to know stuff, and she was always wanting to learn new things, to be a better version of herself. When she was a kid, she was an athletic star. She got top grades, and she kept that sense of purpose about her. She talked about life as if it was a given that it was interesting or exciting, not about mortgages or package holidays or where she was going out on Friday night. I don't want to make her sound manic, obsessed with achievement or anything, because she wasn't like that, because she was calm with it all. It's just that's the way she was always striving, you know, to make life better than it was. So she had high expectations. Yes, but in a good way.
He was refreshing. She was refreshing. Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. She had a different outlook, and it was infectious, if I'm honest. It felt like it brought me out of myself, if that makes sense. It sounds as if your relationship with Emma gave you a sort of zest for life that perhaps you hadn't ever experienced before. It did feel like that, yes. I felt excited about us. I felt a sort of pull to be with her. Did you meet at work? We did. Did you see a lot of each other outside of work? As much as we could? By the time the case went live, she'd kind of moved in with me. So things were getting quite serious for you. She kept her own flat, but she stayed over most nights. We didn't really discuss it, it just sort of happened. Did you introduce Emma to your family? Yes, she met them twice. Both times when my parents came up to Bristol and we went out for a meal. How did that go? It was very nice. They really liked her. She even charmed my dad. Did you meet Emma's parents? No. Any reason for that? Not really. I suppose I figured I'd meet them at some point, when she was ready. I knew she wasn't close to them. She never went to visit them, and they never came to see her, or not that I knew of, anyway. Did you wonder why that was? She said they'd had a falling out. Did she say why? She didn't really explain. I got the impression her dad was quite strict, classic army type, not an easy man. But I'm not really sure, to be honest. That was the one thing about her. She was very private about her family. Weren't you curious? A bit. But she didn't make a big deal about it, and we had a lot else going on, so I didn't really think about it. So you recommended Emma for the FLO role? I did, yes. Was that a risk? I didn't think so, no. I thought she'd do a fantastic job. Emma was one of the best new DCs to come through in years. Everybody said so. Was it professional of you to recommend her, given that you were having a relationship? It wasn't unprofessional. Are you sure about that? Yes, I'm sure. Look, I broke a personal rule getting involved with Emma. I never wanted to have a relationship with somebody at work, but when it happened, it felt totally right. So I went with it. But when this opportunity came up, I thought she was absolutely the right person for that role. Genuinely. Why would I put my neck on the line otherwise? Okay, I understand that. It's clear from your report that this case was a very big moment in your career. Bring it on, are the words you used, I think. That's how I felt. You were excited. The challenge of it, the possibility. To shine? I suppose so. I wasn't going to put it quite like that. It was my first chance to be involved in a very high-profile investigation. You wanted to prove yourself. It was a chance. And your first big task was to prepare for the press conference? After the initial interviews, yep. I watched the footage of the conference. I think everybody did. Once seen, never forgotten. Indeed. You were there too. I saw you. I was chairing it. Why not Fraser? She believes in giving people a chance. She gave me the responsibility for running it and for drafting the statement that we wanted Rachel Jenner to read. I worked with a forensic psychologist on that. It was a big responsibility. So your aim was to appeal to Ben's abductor, to use the mother to obtain their sympathy with the hope that that might persuade them to get in contact with you? With us, or with somebody around them, somebody they trusted. It was important that they saw Ben as a real person, not just an acquisition or a means to their own end. It would give him the context of a loving family. It was equally important not to alienate the abductor. We wanted to make them aware that it wasn't too late for them to give him back, if he was still alive, that it was never too late to do that, even if they were scared of the consequences. We wanted to present a friendly face. At that stage, it obviously wasn't clear whether it was an abduction or a murder. So you scripted something for Rachel to read out that would cover all bases? Yes, that was the idea anyway. How did you know that you could rely on her to get the tone right? I don't know. Did you consider getting his father to do it? We considered it, but there was something about him that we weren't sure would look good on camera. He was a surgeon. He was used to being authoritative. We were concerned that he might appear arrogant. What you want is a mother's warmth. And you were confident in advance that she could deliver that. We didn't have time to delve into her psyche. She was his mother. We assumed that she would, because at that stage we had no reason not to. Day 3. Tuesday the 23rd of October, 2012. Be aware of your public status. Although this might not be the kind of fame you want, You may attain some sort of celebrity standing because of your continuous involvement with the media. Therefore, for your child's sake, conduct yourself as if all eyes were upon you. Don't do things that might cast you in a negative light. When your child is missing, a family survival guide, Missing Kids USA Parental Guide, U.S. Department of Justice, OJJDP report. Webpage, www.247news.co.uk/Bristol, 6:18 a.m. British Standard Time, 23rd of October, 2012. Fears are building for the safety of Benedict Finch, 8 years old, who went missing in Lee Woods near Bristol on Sunday afternoon, by Danny Deal. Detective Chief Inspector Corin Fraser last night said that police are deeply concerned for the safety of the missing boy. "You've seen the weather we've been having," she said. "Cold, rain. You don't want a small child to be out in that." "It is possible that Benedict has been subject of a criminal act," she added, but stressed that all lines of inquiry remained open. "At present, nobody is detained, nobody is a suspect." Members of the public are being urged to phone in with any information that might relate to Benedict. "We would urge people to come forward if they think they might have any information that could help us find this little boy." DCI Fraser revealed that they'd already received 130 calls to a hotline dedicated to the boy's disappearance. "I would like to give our sincere thanks to the public for their support in the search for Ben," she said, "and urge people to report to Abbotsley Village Hall, where a volunteer centre has been set up to coordinate search efforts. Anyone with information can call the missing hotline number 0300 300 3331. Five people are discussing this article. Donald McKeer. "We should keep this little boy in our hearts. Newspapers have offered £25,000 reward. Good on them. Hope he's home safe soon." Jane Evans Brown. "Where's his dad in all this?" Jamie Frick. "Something strange about this. How does a kid get lost in the woods? Why wasn't Mum looking out for him?" Catherine Alexander. "It seems odd. Perhaps the police are not telling everything." Susan Franks. "The police are only releasing what they need to. Let them get on with their jobs and pray for this little boy and his poor family. Hope he is found safe and well."
Rachel. In the car on the way to Kenneth Steele House, gobbets of sound blurted out of the police radio on the dashboard, and the stop and start motions of the commuter traffic made the ride uncomfortable and slow. Nikki had put on makeup and a perfume that was sickly. I wound down the window a little to dilute the smell, but the air I let in was dirty and damply cold. Nikki and Laura had persuaded me to wear a skirt, boots and shirt, so that I would appear presentable. They hadn't been able to do anything about my forehead. The gash was too angry and raw. I didn't care what I looked like. None of us had spoken much. Just a few murmurs of advice from Laura about how to face a camera from her college media training, which I hadn't been able to concentrate on, but had nodded just the same. In the kitchen, just before we left, they'd left me alone momentarily, and I saw the notepad Nikki had been using the night before. It lay face down on the table. I flipped it over, knowing I shouldn't, unable to stop myself. "Notes," Nikki had underlined, and then she'd jotted down some statistics. 532 missing kids, UK, 2011 to 2012. I read on. 82% abductions are family kidnappings. Of non-family abductions, 38% kids taken by friend or long-term acquaintance, 5% by neighbour, 6% by persons of authority, 4% caretaker or babysitter, 37% by strangers, 8% slight acquaintances. There was more. Crime is most often a result of interactions between motivated offenders, available targets, and lack of vigilant guardianship to prevent crime. I couldn't stop reading. I was transfixed by it, carried along by the dry academic tone and the horror of the content. The next paragraph began, "First law enforcement response is critical." She'd underlined that, two lines drawn so hard that they'd gouged the page. What I started to read next was worse. "When abducted child is killed, killer..." Before I got further, Nikki came back into the room and snatched the notepad from me.
Don't look at that, she said. Not now.
She ripped off the pages of notes and put them in her handbag.
You mustn't look. We're not there yet. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have left it out.
How the hell are you finding this stuff?
I asked.
What is it? Where's it from? Show me.
I held my hand out for the notes, but she wasn't having any of it.
Don't concern yourself with that. Honestly, Rachel, don't think about it. Let's go. It's time to go. Let me look at you one more time.
She held me gently by the shoulders, looked me over, a frown fleetingly crossing her brow when she looked at my forehead. And all the while I searched her eyes for clues to what she'd read, to how and where she'd found the information so quickly, and to the side of her personality which allowed her the detachment to look at the darkest side of this, in a way that I simply couldn't contemplate. At the police station, they showed me into the same room as the previous day. Somebody had arranged 4 jammy dodgers on a plate for us. The centers of the biscuits were crimson and resinous, like excretions from a wound. The room smelled of stewed tea. I sat there with Nicky Chang and Clemo going over a statement that he wanted me to read out, an appeal to Ben's abductor. I looked over the words with a sense of detachment and surrealism. They didn't resemble my speech in any way. I felt deeply uneasy. Clemo was like a coiled spring.
Are you going to be okay with this?
He said.
I think so.
It's important that you're calm and clear as much as possible. It's absolutely paramount that we don't alienate the abductor.
I took shallow breaths, focused on the page in front of me. The words swam across it.
Are you sure you can do it?
He asked again. His voice sounded pressured, desperate for a yes.
Do you want me to do it?
Nicky asked. I looked at her, her face straining with the need to help. What could I say? I was his mother.
No. I want to do it. I have to do it.
Good girl.
It was enough for Clemo. He was up out of his chair, checking his watch.
Will you be ready to go in 15?
He said. I nodded.
I'll see you in there. I'll be sitting right by you. Emma, bring them down in 10 minutes. Cabot room.
In Chang's wake, Nicky and I travelled carpeted corridors until we reached a set of double doors, labelled Cabot room. Inside, I was invited to take my place behind a narrow table that was set up at one end of the room. The lineup was Chang, me, Clemo, DCI Fraser, and John, who acknowledged me with a nod, his jaw set in an effort to control his emotions. Nicky found a place at the side of the room. She had to stand because every chair was taken. The room was packed with journalists. TV cameras were set up at the back, photographers beside them. There were more lenses trained on me than I could count. Those who were sitting had laptops or tablets or recording devices, which they were busy checking. Behind us, the wall was emblazoned with a large Avon and Somerset police logo, and on each side of that, 2 identical posters had been put up, showing Ben's photo and a phone number and email address for information. On the table in front of us was a bank of microphones, wires snaking from the back of them. I poured myself an inch of water from a carafe and sipped it. My mouth was dry, my heart thumping. The noise in the room was oppressive. Motor drives and voices meshed together to make a messy ball of sound from which my name sometimes erupted. Clemo called the room to order on a signal from DCI Fraser. I clutched my script, forced my eyes to run over the words. I hadn't really come to terms with what they wanted me to say. The carefully modulated phrases that they'd written for me made me recoil. Clemo started things off, and he was concise and authoritative. He spoke briefly and then introduced me, telling the room that I was going to read out a statement. I put my script on the table and smoothed it out, cleared my voice.
Please,
I said, but my voice died away. I started again.
Please, can I appeal to anyone who knows anything about Ben's disappearance to contact the police, as D.I. Clemo has requested? Ben is only 8 years old. He's very young. And the best place for him to be is at home, where he can be with his family and friends, because we all love him very much, and it is making us very anxious not knowing whether he is safe and well.
I felt tears running down my face. I heard my voice get twisted up by my grief. I felt Chang's hand on my back, saw Clemo shift uneasily in his seat beside me. I took a deep, shuddering breath and went on.
If you are the person who is with Ben, then please make contact. You don't need to ring the police directly. You can talk to a solicitor, or someone you trust, and they will help you get him home safely. This is an unusual situation for all of us.
I dried up again. I'd reached the bit of the speech I hated. Clemo's words ran round in my head.
Remember, we want to humanize the situation,
he'd said.
That's why we're offering the abductor a chance for forgiveness, so that they aren't afraid to get in contact.
I tried to gather myself. Clemo whispered something in my ear, but I couldn't hear what he said, because it was then that I heard John sob. He was hunched over the table, his head in his hands, his face red and distorted. He began to cry noisily, his shoulders heaving, his grief physical and terrible. I gave up trying to read. I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't say the words on the script, and, most powerfully of all, I couldn't fight the idea that had crept into my head with a certainty and clarity that almost took my breath away. I carefully folded up the script, placed it in front of me. You see, the thought that I had was this: that Ben and his abductor were watching. They were watching John break down and watching me speak words that weren't mine. Submissive, tame words. I was sure of it, and I couldn't stand it any longer. I stood up. And all the camera lenses in the room rose too, trained on my face. I moved my gaze along them, and, in my mind, through each one, I met the eye of Ben's abductor.
"Give him back,"
I said.
"Give him back, or I will hunt you down myself. I will find you if it takes me my whole life. I will find you, and I will make you pay."
Then, as Clemo was saying,
"Miss Jenna,"
and standing beside me, not knowing how to stop me, I spoke to my son. I looked deep down those lenses, willing Ben to hear my words, and I said,
"I love you, Ben. If you are watching, I love you, and I'm going to find you. Love, I'm coming to get you, I promise."
I smiled at him. I was entranced by the fact that I might have just managed the first communication with my son since he disappeared, imagining him hearing my words in a strange place somewhere and feeling less alone, less confused, perhaps even feeling hope. The reporters began to call to me then, but I felt triumphant. If Ben was watching, then I had just made contact with him. He hadn't witnessed his parents simply looking broken, his mother speaking in words that weren't hers. Instead, I'd told him that I was going to find him. Now, I felt euphoric, as if I'd done something that was really and truly right and honest, something pure, even, amidst the horror of it all. And in my naivety, I felt sure that that rightness and honesty should have some power to lead us to Ben. I glanced at D.I. Clemo, wanting a show of support from him. but he looked as though he'd just been slapped hard across his hollowed-out cheeks. The cameras were still all trained on me, and the journalists were scribbling in their pads or typing.